KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest, writer-director Edgar Wright, has been here for, with the exception of his first film, Shaun of the Dead, everything he has done. He was here for Hot Fuzz. He was here for, what's that little movie called? Oh, yes, Scott Pilgrim. And now he's here for his newest film, The World's End. It's always a pleasure to have you here.
I think I was also here for the Space DVD as well.
You were here for Space. I was only talking about the films, but thank you for...
Oh, there you go.
I'm going to go and Edgar's going to take over the show. I guess I have to ask you this. People love drinking in your projects, don't they? There's a lot of alcohol consumption.
Yeah.
You can't, I mean, it's, I hate to use the cliche, a social lubricant, but it is that.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I can only speak as a Brit. I know it's exactly the same in this country in a way, and in other countries. It's not like it's a specifically British thing, but it's definitely like, I think there's something about, like, there's something fun in playing up to the stereotype of Brits being drunks, like, which I've definitely, having lived over in the States, I'm sort of aware of that, of, like, the what people perceive the Brits to be like, and I think it's because it's about 75% true. But, you know, there's something that it's just a huge part of the culture, and especially when you're younger, there's definitely that peer pressure in terms of drinking, and then also the idea of even the older guys, that's sort of like a way of kind of escaping like from their job or maybe their kind of like sort of other halves and stuff, is that people will go out and get way too drunk. You know, I think the thing, we have a thing with the licensing laws in the UK, is because the bars shut earlier, you have this binge drinking thing, which doesn't really exist in this country.
And you also have the thing, too, where a lot of these pubs are kind of the social center of people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, much more so, it's more acceptable because, you know, I guess like here, bars, like neighborhood bars are more for, you know, bar fly is a particular kind of like sort of the kind of person who would be in that bar every night. Like in the UK, it is something where like a lot of bars are for families, or you have kids in there as well, or like it's a gathering place. But it is also something, you know, what's in all three movies, but especially in Shaun of the Dead and The World's End, like it's about me and Simon's love-hate relationship with the pub. It's something that's so sort of part of British culture, and yet sometimes I feel trapped in them, you know, where it's something where it's such an easy meeting place. Like I could walk to about 10 pubs in about 60 seconds, and I'd say 75% of them look the same.
But this that thing, I end up associating your movies in a weird way with Mike Lee and Ken Loach for that reason, because of that, because of those pubs in a way, what we call here community centers, where a large part of life takes part in them.
Yeah, and it, you know, in a funny way, like sort of, you know, we started to sort of, especially with the new one, The World's End, we'd started to feel like the movies are actually like Trojan horses, that we had essentially made like a zombie film, a cop film, and with this one a sci-fi film. But that's the sort of, you know, that's the cover, what, you know, we're smuggling in this relationship comedy. And like, we love Mike Lee, you know, like his big like inspiration to so many people in comedy. But, you know, there's a certain type of audience that will go and see a Mike Lee film, and actually what's nice of some of our films is there's a completely different kind of audience that would never see a Mike Lee or a Ken Loach film. And so there's an element of like smuggling going on in a way, and it's something where I feel very pleased. And I think maybe it's even sort of something that's only really occurred to us having made three of these movies, is that we actually get the most pleasure from the personal stuff in the movies. Not to say that we don't like doing the action and the sci-fi stuff, because that's like an absolute thrill to kind of put that on the big screen. But then when I watch it back, I'm always like most proud of the fact that we managed to do something, hopefully, that like is a little more challenging in a comedy, maybe just because it's more honest, you know?
And I've never really talked to you about this before. I do connect you to those guys, to Loach and Lee.
Wow, I take that as high praise.
Wow, I'm just hoping it's
funny. I did, like, this is a funny thing, but it was like a cringeworthy experience. Like, I'm a big fan of Mike Lee, and ironically, when we first pitched Shaun of the Dead to Film 4, this was before actually Working Title came in, Film 4 briefly, we developed it with them, and they went bankrupt, actually. So Eric Fellner from Working Title came in to save the day and save Shaun of the Dead from turnaround. But what's funny is when we pitched it to Film 4, this was way before, like, we tried to pitch to them in the way that they would understand as a sort of like a maker of art house films. And we said, imagine Life is Sweet with zombies. So it was like the idea of doing a Mike Leigh film. So then way later, like when we actually made the film, I was at the BAFTAs because it got nominated for Best British Film. Didn't win. But got nominated. But that Mike Leigh was at the party afterwards and he came up to me and he goes, oh, congratulations on your film. And I said, oh, that's, thank you so much. I'm such a big fan. And, you know, it's ironic because I actually pitched your movie as like Life is Sweet with more zombies. And he just said, well, it certainly had more zombies, and walked off. And I was like, oh, my God. It was like a horrific thing. And did he like it? Did he hate it? Does he hate me? Mike, come back. No, don't go. It was like one of those horrific things when you meet your heroes and you think, oh, God, did I just drop a complete clanger? Like, so, Mike, if you're listening, I love you.
He's a big listener to this show. It's the treatment. My guest, who's basically just slagged off an elder statesman in the British film.
I didn't slag him off at all. I love him.
Whose newest film as writer-director is The World's End. This is a point where you get to do something you haven't done for a while and tell the audience what the movie's about.
Five friends who are teenagers. You join them 20 years later. Four of them have become grown-ups. And one of them absolutely has not and has kind of become this rather like a dark Peter Pan. Somebody who's kind of just trying to cling on to his teenage years. And that's Simon Pegg's character, Gary King. And he's the guy who was the coolest guy at school. And now he's not quite so cool anymore. And he's kind of like clinging on to former glories. And so he drags his friends back to their hometown to try and recreate this pub crawl they did when they were 19. And it's a cautionary tale of the dangers of nostalgia. And when Simon's character tries to forcibly turn the clock back with the magic time machine known as alcohol, things go very badly wrong.
Well, see, because one of the reasons I thought about Mike Leigh too is just that the scene after the opening where Gary introduces us to that pivotal moment in his life, there's a scene in rehab that's very much like a Mike Leigh scene to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny, like when we first did the first draft of the script, somebody said, do you think this is too dark? And we thought, I think you have to have that scene in there. You have to know that there's some kind of ticking time bomb. That, like, sort of there's something else is going on with Gary and that this is going to rear its head later and that sort of, like, I think that's what's kind of, like, it's exciting making something that's, like, I don't even want to call it black comedy because I think sometimes black comedy sounds, if this sounds right, but sometimes the term black comedy seems to me that it makes it seem like the makers of the film are misanthropic. Do you know what I mean? That there's something sort of, like, cynical in terms of, there's a cynical sense of humor. I don't think that's always true, but I think it's less about being intentionally dark or black comedy as it is more about being kind of honest. So that's, I think, what we sort of try to do is talk about these characters and they've got kind of flaws and problems, but sort of tackle them head on. And I think it's almost in a sort of response to a lot of the American, like, man-child comedies that you see, where usually the act structure of the American man-child comedies, and I'd say these for the good ones as well as the many, many bad ones, is that it starts with, like, act one, like, so-and-so is a big kid. Act two, but maybe it's not so good to be a big kid. And act three is like, you know what? It's okay to be a big kid. And that's the movie. And so with this is, like, sort of, let's do something about that, but let's, like, there is no going back. It's like something has to give. And so that was the idea, really. So it wasn't something like we have, even with Simon's character, who is incredibly flawed, and out of all of the characters we've ever written, somebody who's the most troubled and also, like, delusional and selfish and kind of, like, needy and sort of desperate, but me and Simon have real compassion for him. We, the movie is kind of about him trying to get himself out of a spiral. And even as he pushes his friends away who are trying to help him, like, as kind of things get sort of, like, more and more desperate in terms of... This is a comedy, by the way. as things get more desperate, like, with the fate of the world hanging in the balance. Like, I want Gary King, Simon's character, to pull himself out of this spiral.
Oh, it's a treat. My guest who's trying to talk you out of seeing his movie is Edgar Wright. Go see it anyway.
It's very funny. It's got pratfalls in it as well.
The World's End of the movie. But having spent time in the UK, I have to ask if Gary King is named after the Gary King, the big sort of British DJ who has a big 90s show.
No, it isn't. It's just one of those. I think I knew other people with, I definitely knew some Garys at school, and I definitely knew some people with the surname King. And it was just something where it's not named after that DJ at all.
But that DJ basically spends a lot of time. I mean, he has these shows that are about eras of past. It's a big 90s show.
That's funny. You know what? I think maybe, no, it's funny. Somebody else mentioned him the other day, and I had not put the two and two together. I think sort of for some reason, I don't know why the name Gary came to our minds. I know that we wanted him to have the surname King, because he's nicknamed himself the King and also King Gary. I like this idea of somebody who's coined a nickname for themselves, that he thinks if he repeats it enough times, people will start calling him that. So it's
which nobody does, by the way.
Well, none of his friends do. Well, without spoiling too much.
Nobody calls him that as a compliment.
Yes. Well, it's also that thing like there's that thing when you're swearing but not swearing that you do in the UK where you put an apostrophe before the King, like King Gary. You know, like, I might swear on the treatment, obviously.
Thank you.
But so we just thought it was like a great name to sort of like, for somebody who is a self-styled like King Arthur of his group, he wants to be this kind of like sort of leading his, you know, merry men on a quest, that he is their king. He's King Gary. So it was just like, that's the perfect surname.
Well, it's also too the sort of great sort of combination of sort of royalty and informality, King Gary.
It's interesting. I never really looked into the history of that surname. I know what my surname means, because Wright means a craftsman of some type. You have a Wainwright or a Wheelwright, but King. I guess it must be something to do in terms of something to do with King's Guards or something. It's definitely not royalty, because most people with the surname King are from lower middle class to working class. So I think that's probably what it is. It's probably working as a King's Guard.
Well, it's interesting too, just because I've just found myself thinking just about British films. And I know when I saw you a few days ago, we talked about this, but I found myself thinking a lot about the old Bill Forsyth comedies and watching this.
Yeah. Funny enough, there's something at the start of the movie is a 5-minute opening sequence where Simon's character is narrating his perfect night from 1990. Very much based on, I went on a pub crawl when I was, 19. And I have this hazy recollection of, the night. But, you know, it's particularly when you think about those summer nights that just go on forever, and where you just, you know, in the middle of, June or July, where it kind of doesn't get dark until 10 o'clock at night. And I always have these memories of these long summer nights. And it's quite an idyllic moment of, particular sort of summer, where me and my friends, 5 of my friends, much like in the movie, would be in the same pubs in town every single night, and we would be as thick as thieves, and we'd left school, but we were all working summer jobs, but we would always meet in these particular bars. And I always think that sort of there's something that's very sort of vivid to me about that kind of that summer. And one of the films, I mentioned 2 American films and 1 British film, 2 American films that capture that. One is American Graffiti, captures that brilliantly. Another is then Days to Confuse, which captures that brilliantly. But the British one that I always think is just the perfect encapsulation of a long summer night is Gregory's Girl.
Sure.
Because the ending of that movie is so beautiful, and so it's got that great ending where you feel that there's so much possibility, and also the feeling that the two characters that you're watching might not even be talking to each other in 3 weeks' time. Do you know what I mean? You don't feel this is fleeting. It feels like this is young teenage love, but this is fleeting and this might not last. But I love that film. It's beautiful.
We'll take a break after having had a first interview that references both Ken Loach and John Sturges. It's The Treatment by, I guess, Edgar Wright. We're talking about his new film, World's End. The World's End. Forgive me for leaving out the article. There's more to come. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
I'm Jenny Radelet, producer of The Treatment. KCRW is a nonprofit public radio station. We thrive on the support of listeners like you. Make a donation at kcrw.com/join.
Welcome back to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell, talking with Edgar Wright. His new film is The World's End. We were dissecting man-boy films before in the first half. But I want to get more back a bit more to Bill Forsyth, because I also think in terms of local hero and one of my favorite movies, Comfort and Joy, there's a kind of a loneliness about these guys who can't quite fit in anywhere that I find reflected in your movies.
I think sometimes there's two things that you do when you're writing characters. Is when people say, like, are any of the characters in the film you? I think you always have to answer, I think they're all kind of bits of me and Simon. Like, you end up writing, there's two things that you do, is that you sort of try and exercise your own demons on screen. And the other thing is that you try and be a better man on screen than you are in reality. I always think that with Shaun of the Dead, I always think that it was like a sort of a long apology for being a lazy boyfriend to my ex-girlfriend. Like, I think that we definitely...
Did she see it, the film? And
oh, yeah. In fact, she, not only did she see the film, she was at the Arclight last night. That's the sort of... I've got a pretty good record of being okay with my ex-girlfriend, so that's good. But like I said, she did see it and she loves it, so that's good. And she, in fact, she worked on the movie even after we split up. So it's all good. But I do think that we gravitate towards characters who are flawed. I don't think there's any comedy in a perfect person.
But they're also, your protagonists almost always tend to be these sort of singular, lonely guys,
yeah,
who can't really connect. And again, I think about Peter Riegert in Local Hero, or Bill Patterson in Comfort and Joy. I mean, because that sort of embracing of the culture, of a very local culture, that's part of what, I mean, I think the best British filmmakers do, that sort of separates them from American filmmakers. I think the best British films tend to be regional in a way that American films are not.
Yeah. I think also something about, like, the UK is a tiny island in comparison to the sort of, I think you can fit the UK into Texas, can't you?
And still have room left over for Scotland.
So that makes actually sort of like the journeys into, and yet at the same time, like, the Wicker Man feels like sort of Edward Woodward is taking sort of like a sort of a journey into another dimension, you know, like sort of you can become like sort of like get lost in like a sort of a small county. It's kind of what Hot Fuzz is about, is the thing of like having to move from London to the country. Now, in reality, I think it's a psychological thing, because like the difference between like the drive between London and where I grew up is 3.5 hours. Now, like, to people in like big countries here, that's nothing.
No, that's the drive from here to San Diego.
Exactly. But to me, that is like an entirely like parallel universe. So there's something very interesting about that. And I think then in some of these movies, you can kind of get lost on a very small journey, you know. And so, you know, it's almost like what we wanted to do with like with this movie, The World's End, is when kind of like Gary wants to go back to this hometown. And we always kind of figure that the hometown is probably not that far away from London, but it feels like they've gone to Siberia. But I think where we gravitate towards these kind of like sort of loners is, I don't know, I think it's sort of something kind of, I mean, I think Sean is probably the sort of, he has connections, but he's somebody who has to kind of find his own kind of like level. In Shaun of the Dead, it's
but he's kind of at the point where we meet him, he's kind of being ostracized from that group that he has.
Yeah, because also he's not kind of really committing to anything. He's not committing to work. He's not committing to his girlfriend. The only person that, and he's kind of being dragged backwards by his stoner friend. So it's somebody that has to like, he's at that kind of like that point in his life where it's like, well, what do you want to be? Where do you want to go? What are you going to do? And he literally needs a slap in the face, which is zombies. Nicholas Angel is a complete loner because he's become such a workaholic.
Nicholas Angel is the protagonist of Hot Fuzz.
Of Hot Fuzz, and he has become such a workaholic that he has no friends, and that he's kind of like sort of sacrificed everything for his work and just has become like inhuman, you know.
But these films almost all start, even Scott Pilgrim, with somebody kind of being pushed out of the group because of his singularity.
Yeah. But yeah, I think sort of it's all like sort of finding like characters that like need to kind of like grow up in some way, or at least kind of like change something about themselves. It's the struggle between kind of like fitting in with what's expected of you, but it's really about finding some kind of like personal happiness or equilibrium, really.
Because there's this film as well, and Scott Pilgrim, there's a relationship issue, and then these guys have been pushed out of relationships for that reason.
Yeah. I mean, in this one, I think it's sort of a bit kind of like a little bleaker, but we sort of like hint at the start that nobody's happy. You know, that like Simon's character is definitely not happy.
And the reason that they're all getting together again, because they want to try to at least recapture some of that feeling of joy that was been missing from their lives.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, you know, I had that sort of, in terms of working out things on screen, there's that feeling when, you know, you get busy with work and stuff and you don't see your old friends as much as you feel you should. Like, I don't need to be back in my hometown, but sometimes I feel guilty that I went away. I don't know why. It's sort of that strange kind of, like, sort of feel very conflicted about it in terms of, like, and in fact, my parents have now moved away from my hometown completely, and they didn't have any family there. They were sort of, we were, like, a new family in that town. So it's a very strange thing to kind of, like, be completely cut off from your anchor in terms of, like, oh, I don't really have any reason to go back. Or if I did, there's nobody to visit there anymore. That's quite a strange feeling, you know. I think that's that thing is, as you're trying to go forward in life, you sort of want to make sure that your kind of like sort of past is in some way safe, which of course it isn't, because like a town is going to change without you. Like sort of the people are going to move away. And so you know, I mean, I think I definitely, out of the three of us, out of me, Simon, and Nick, I'm definitely the most nostalgic. I think Nick Frost kind of like absolutely happily just looks forward and is not sentimental about the past in the slightest. Whereas I do get kind of like sort of strangely sentimental about things of which I have, you know, I think about going back to school and trying to do better. Or I think about going on dates again and doing like things differently. And so I wonder why I have these Groundhog Day sort of time travel fantasies. And so the only way I can work it out is either see a psychiatrist or make this movie. It turned out to be the latter, so I hope it works.
I do too. We've got an incredibly doer with Edgar Wright, who's a new film.
Hey, guys, this film is really funny.
You may remind
like,
us of comedy.
Some people say it's a laugh riot.
Here's a laugh riot. The film we're talking about is The World's End. It's The Treatment. But I do think that you come out of that tradition of British filmmakers and that everything you've done has been so region-specific. Mm. I mean, with Scott Pilgrim and those great graphic novels, they're very much about that city and that place and what being in that place means and how you connect or disconnect from that place and walking around and having these touchstones in your life. And I feel like that connects you to a tradition, a long tradition of that kind of region-specific British filmmaker.
I think that's true, but I also think there's something is that if you are very specific in what you write, you know, you're not necessarily making a completely mainstream film, but I think it has kind of bigger echoes for people in terms of I think it just resonates more. So like Shaun of the Dead is not like a sort of a massively commercially successful film, but it has resonated a lot longer because people watch it, and even in other countries, they recognize themselves in the movie. And I think in this movie as well, even though it couldn't be more British in a way, there are lots of aspects of it that people sort of say, I know that guy. Or even worse, I am that guy. People sort of, I've had quite a few people say, the only bummer about your film is I feel like I am Simon Pegg's character. So I think there's something like, but we realize that when we were writing, at least with the three British films that I've done, is that by being very specific, you actually sort of get more appreciation from viewers in a way. Like, the thing is, when you make a mainstream film that gets really big, you just have to kind of, things just get blanded out because there's, you know, they don't want to offend anybody or anything, and it's just trying to be so universal. So it's nice with these movies is actually sort of like they're just at the budget level where you can do something hopefully quite idiosyncratic, but still have like the laughs and chases and action scenes that kind of like make it, you know, a commercial film.
Well, the thing I always find kind of funny in movies too is just you were going out of your way to pick the worst cars anybody could ever have.
I'm glad you said that.
Yes, I had to bring it up to you again. I can't think of it. And just, this doesn't tend to come up much, but the cars you pick in these movies are just awful, awful cars.
I just like seeing, like, terrible cars in car chases. Because, listen, there's been, like, 6 Fast and the Furious, like, movies. You don't need any more muscle cars on the big screen.
Well, apparently you don't, but no. But the world does. But go ahead.
Listen, I've done action scenes with a Jetta. I've done an action scene with a Ford Focus, a Granada. like Amperas, a Vauxhall Ampera. None of these are sexy cars.
Not even close.
So I like
these
that.
These are cars for Americans. They always blow up on Top Gear.
Well, what's funny to me is that I obviously working with stunts, I have a great experience on this one with the stunt team. Like I'm the stunt coordinator, Adam Curley. He is a very young stuntman. Like he's maybe about 32 now, but like back on Casino Royale,
he was in his 20s.
Yeah. And he did that stunt in the Audi, like the rolling stunt, which is amazing. It's like sort of, so as a stuntman in his mid-20s, he did that roll in the Audi. So it's funny then to hire him for this movie, and he has to do a car chase featuring a Ford Focus.
Yes.
Maybe it's even a Kia, actually. It's not. It is a Kia.
I can't think of anybody else who's done car chases with cars with four-cylinder engines in them.
We actually, if you notice in that point of the sequence, we put in this, like I said, I want it to sound like, you know, they have to also going up hills, so they have to go down a gear. I want it to sound like it's going, that horrific noise of like, I always remember vividly when I was I have only owned one car in my life.
What's the car?
It was a terrible, like a ginger coloured Vauxhall Chevette. It was like orange and horrible. And I bought it for £200. And then
did you get some money back?
And when it died, I went to sort of, it died, like the starter motor gave up. And I could not afford to replace it. So, I haven't got a car anymore. This is when I was a student. I could not afford to replace the starter motor. So I sold it for scrap, and I sold it for £20. And it was like, I took it to the scrapyard. He goes, £20. I was thinking, really? And I did this thing. I've never kept a car since. When I walked away, I actually sort of touched the car, and I said, goodbye, old girl. And I walked up this horrible, like, Chevette. But I remember, like, vividly, my friend had an Austin Allegro, which is another really crappy car, although quite nice design on it.
It's stylish, a bit
more stylish.
But basically a car that, you know, by the time you get rid of it, you know your mechanic's number by heart.
Absolutely. My friend had one, and for some reason, on a long, long straight outside of our town, there was this, like, sort of road where it had no junctions for, like, a long straight.
It wasn't terrifying to go in that car and drive a long distance, wasn't it?
Oh, no, it wasn't so much that. It's that we wanted to try and drive it as fast as we possibly could. And don't do this at home, kids. So we drove this Austin Allegro, and we got up to 100 miles an hour. Well, we got up to 80, and when we went past, this was a car that sounded like it was a complete rust bucket, and you could kind of hear it kind of, like, starting to die. And I always remember that, like, when we went over 80 miles an hour, it suddenly achieved this period of grace where it went completely silent. And I just think, oh, my God, the car just died. Like, it literally was going, and I went, and thinking, what just happened? It's like we just went into car heaven. It was like we literally, something happened. It achieved, like, it had an out-of-body experience, this Austin Allegro. And my friend Ian, who actually sort of, Martin Freeman's character is partly based on, because I actually went out with Ian's cute younger sister. A lot of the stuff in the film is autobiographical, but my friend Ian, who had the Austin Allegro, said it was never the same after that. Once it had gone into this silent warp speed, so I don't know. A lot of these kind of like sort of experiences somehow go into the movie. But you're right, I've done some very unsexy car scenes, Elvis. Listen, I'm not Michael Bay.
And on that note, we're out of time. I have to thank Edgar Wright for coming back. Always good to see you. Thanks so much, Edgar.
Oh, it's always lovely to be here.
My guest is director Edgar Wright, whose new film as director is The World's End. I have to thank him for very responsibly warning our young listener, whoever that might be, not to drive too fast. Our recording engineer is J.C. Swatt. The show is mixed by Melissa Morton. It's edited and produced by Jenny Radelet. I'm not a king. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
Find past episodes of The Treatment at kcrw.com or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Listen to The Treatment on demand on your smartphone with KCRW's apps. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.